This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Go by Kazuki Kaneshiro, translated by Takame Niada, performed by Brian Nishi.
What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Romeo and Juliet. 1. Hawaii. I was 14 the first time my old man uttered that word in my presence. We were watching some New Year's special where these three gorgeous actresses jetted off to Hawaii and kept shouting, "Beautiful! Delicious! I'm in heaven!" Up until then, Hawaii was known in our house as the symbol of depraved capitalism. At the time, my father was 54 and held North Korean citizenship. He was what the Japanese call Zainichi Chosenjin, a North Korean resident of Japan, and a Marxist. First, let's get one thing straight. The story that follows is a love story. My love story. And communism, or democratism, pacifism, otakuism, vegetarianism, or any other ism for that matter, has got nothing to do with it. Just so you know. Anyway, when the old man mentioned Hawaii, my mother, also North Korean, clenched her fist in triumph. She whispered to me later, "Your father didn't stand a chance against the infirmities of old age." Tokyo was hit by a severe cold snap that winter, and I guess my father's 54-year-old body was really feeling it, judging from the way he kept rubbing his joints and muttering about his arthritis. He was born in the temperate climate of Jeju, an island province of South Korea, and spent part of his childhood there. By the way, Jeju Island is also the self-proclaimed Hawaii of the East. My mother was born and raised in Japan. She was 19 when my father picked her up at Ameyoko Market in Okachimachi and 20 when she gave birth to me. Seeing how my father was now teetering, my mother spun around behind him and gave him one last push. "The Berlin Wall crumbled and the Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore. Just the other day, the people on TV were talking about how the cold temperatures caused the Soviet Union's fall. The cold freezes people's souls, their ideological beliefs, even," she said with a shiver. I half expected her to burst into a mournful song. My father listened with his body stooped slightly forward as if to keep from toppling over. When he looked up and turned his gaze to the television, the three actresses, now wearing bathing suits, turned their rapt faces toward him and called out, "Aloha!" "Aloha," my father muttered. It sounded like a death moan. My old man let out a long, deep sigh and fell to temptation. Once my father got up off the floor, he acted quickly. As soon as the holidays were over, he began the process of changing his citizenship from North Korean to South Korean so he could visit Hawaii. I should explain. Why did my father, who was born on the South Korean island of Jeju, have North Korean citizenship? And why did he have to change his citizenship to South Korean just to go to Hawaii? It's a tedious story, so I'll try to keep it short and mix in some humor here and there. But don't hold your breath. Back when my father was a kid during World War II, he was a Japanese citizen. Why? Long ago, Korea was a Japanese colony. Forced to adopt a Japanese name, Japanese citizenship, and the Japanese language, my father was destined to fight as a soldier in the Emperor's army when he grew up. He came to Japan as a kid when his parents were drafted to work in the munitions factories. But when Japan was defeated and the war ended, the government no longer allowed him to remain Japanese. And to add insult to injury, the Japanese government said, "We're done with you. Get the hell out of our country." sending Korean residents into a panic. Before they knew what happened, the United States and the Soviet Union had divided the Korean Peninsula into two countries. So Koreans were allowed to stay in Japan, but were forced to choose between South and North Korean nationality. My old man chose North Korea because it touted Marxist ideology and was assumed to be more compassionate toward the poor. And because it showed more concern than the South Korean government for Koreans living in Japan. That's how my father became a North Korean resident of Japan. My aging father, having switched his citizenship twice by a young age, was now attempting to change it a third time. He couldn't get a visa as a North Korean because that country didn't have diplomatic relations with the United States. Since North Korea had so few diplomatic ties with other countries, North Korean residents of Japan were limited in where they could travel. I've heard that you can get a visa for some countries, but with the red tape and hassle, there was no telling how long that could take. So what my father did was appeal to a Mindan leader. Ready for some more tedious explanation? Here goes. In Japan, there are basically two ethnic Korean organizations, Chongryong and Mindan. Generally, North Korean residents of Japan associate with Chongryong and South Korean residents with Mindan. Reflecting the relationship between North and South Korea, and like the feuding Montagues and Capulets, the two groups clash every now and then but maintain a reasonable distance from one another. You know how Romeo and Juliet ended, right? Long ago, my father had been an active member of Chongryong. He spent all his free time fighting for the rights of fellow North Koreans living in Japan and donated tons, I mean tons, of money to the sound management of the organization. But all of his efforts and years of service went unrewarded. I really can't go into the details here, but basically, my father realized that Chongryong was more concerned with North Korea than with the North Koreans living in Japan. Around the same time he'd lost hope in North Korea and Chongryong, the temptation of Hawaii had taken hold. Anyway, the first thing he did to get his South Korean citizenship was talk to someone he knew in the Mindan leadership. This was the same guy who'd asked my father to spy on Chongryong back when he was still involved in their activities. My father refused, so he says. This guy told my father that all you need to do to obtain citizenship is go to the South Korean embassy, fill out the proper forms, and wait for the application to go through. But the waiting period varies from person to person. In the case of someone who has exhibited traitorous inclinations in the past, such as working for Chongryong, and who was a Marxist to boot, who knew how long it would take the application to go through, if at all? No doubt, this uncertainty made my father nervous. Thanks to some backdoor dealing, my father's application sailed through in just 2 months. That must have been some kind of record for a former Chongryong Marxist. What did my old man do, you ask? Simple. He bought off the guy with a massive, I mean massive, amount of money. And that's how my father masterfully obtained citizenship for a third time. He wasn't the least bit impressed with himself, though. "You can buy citizenship to any country you want," he used to joke on occasion. "Which country will it be?" At this point, he could have taken off for Hawaii, but there was one last thing my father needed to do. He needed to send a truck to his brother in North Korea. Which brings me to my last bit of this boring explanation, and there's no finding the humor in this one. My father came to Japan during the war with a brother who was 2 years younger than he was. This brother, my uncle that is, returned to North Korea during the repatriation campaign that began in the late 1950s. The campaign essentially touted North Korea as an earthly paradise, encouraging persecuted North Koreans living in Japan to return to their homeland and forge a life with their compatriots. At the time, most North Koreans had a vague suspicion that nothing good ever came out of anything called a campaign, but thinking it might be better than Japan, where they faced discrimination and poverty, many went back to North Korea anyway. My uncle was among them. I'll never forget that first letter my uncle addressed to me. He had written in beautifully penned Japanese, "Send as much penicillin and as many Casio digital clocks as you can. Please, I need your help." After changing his citizenship to South Korean and effectively betraying Chonggyeong, my father couldn't help but worry about my uncle. My father had never been to North Korea, and now that he had changed his citizenship, there was little chance that he ever would. He would likely never see my uncle again, and neither of them was exactly young anymore. Once again, my father managed to put together a massive sum of money, this time using it to buy a 3-ton truck, which he shipped to North Korea. My uncle had written in one of his letters that if he had had a truck, he might be appointed the head of the local neighborhood association or something. Along with the truck, my father sent a letter explaining his change of citizenship. We never heard from my uncle again. Soon after I entered my final year of junior high school, my old man jetted off to Hawaii with my mother, who had also become a South Korean citizen by then. Aloha! Now a huge framed photo of a pretty Hawaiian girl in a straw skirt kissing my father on the cheek decorates the foyer of the house. In it, he's wearing a hibiscus lei around his neck, grinning from ear to ear as he flashes the peace sign with both hands. Jackass. And me? Finally, I can talk about me. This isn't a story about my father or mother, after all. This story is about me. I didn't go to Hawaii. Why? Since I was the child of parents with North Korean citizenship, I automatically became a Zainichi Chosenjin with North Korean citizenship. Like I said, when I was a kid, I thought that Hawaii was the symbol of depraved capitalism. I grew up surrounded by books written by Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, and Che Guevara. I attended a Chonglyon-run Korean school where I was taught that America was the enemy. Even so, that doesn't mean that I was infected by communist ideology. I didn't give a damn about North Korea, Marx, Chonglyon, Korean schools, or America. I was just living with the circumstances that I happened to be born into. And given those screwed-up circumstances, naturally, I became a misfit. I mean, how could I have turned out otherwise? By the time of my parents' Hawaii adventure, I developed into a fine misfit. So I rebelled against my father over changing citizenship. It wasn't that I had any hang-ups about it, but I had no intention of giving in so easily. One spring day, just before the start of my third and final year of junior high school, my old man forced me into the car and started driving. I asked him where he was taking me, but he continued to drive the car in silence, out of Tokyo and toward Kanagawa. He's going to kill me. Why such an extreme reaction? My father had been a nationally ranked lightweight boxer and was the type to punch first and ask later. Punk that I was, I'd gotten hauled into the police station a number of times over some mischief that I'd pulled. My father nearly beat me to death 3 times. As I racked my brain for a way to jump out of the car, we arrived at our destination, Tsuchido Beach in Shonan. After pulling the car over to the side of the seaside road, he slammed the car door and started walking toward the beach. "Come with me!" Although the image of my father holding my head underwater until I drowned flashed before my eyes for a split second as I watched his back, I didn't sense any bloodlust. I decided to follow him to see what this was all about. He trudged ahead of me in the sand, plunked himself down in the middle of the beach, and stared out at the water. I calculated the precise distance that would put me safely out of his reach and took a seat next to him. I deliberately sat on his right. My father was a southpaw. He gazed at the sun setting over the early spring ocean, saying nothing. Meanwhile, I was checking out a cute teenager walking a golden retriever. When our eyes met, she gave me a coy smile. Just as I was about to smile back at her, I sensed a murderous rage on my left. I cursed myself for letting down my guard. My father's fist was flying toward my head. I'm dead. I felt his knuckles rap lightly against the side of my head.
Look straight ahead, he said.
Having escaped what I thought was certain death, I turned toward the ocean and stared. Several minutes passed, and after mumbling something about how he should have chosen a prettier spot, my father turned and fixed a hard look on me. I was terrified. His eyes were dead serious. The 2-inch scar at the corner of one eye from his boxing days had turned crimson. I was thinking about cracking a smile to lighten the mood when he finally opened his mouth.
Take a good look at the wide world, he said. You decide the rest.
That was it. After saying this, he rose to his feet and left me sitting there on the beach. I didn't hate him for pulling such a cheesy stunt. Though I may have been a misfit, I was also a romantic. That part about the wide world really got my heart pumping. I sat there on the beach and stared ahead. The ocean was wide open and free. As the sunset gave way to moonlight, I ached with the yearning to put my boat in the water and sail to distant countries. And so, I gave in. Sure, my father's cheesy performance had something to do with it, but that wasn't the only reason. I had grown up trapped in an environment over which I had no control, but now I had been given a choice. North Korea or South Korea? As horribly limited as my options were, the choice was mine to make. I felt as if I was being treated like a human with rights for the first time in my life. I agreed to change my citizenship to South Korean, but refused to go on the trip to Hawaii with my parents. I asked my father if he'd let me use the travel expenses for something else instead.
For what?
He asked. I want to go to a Japanese high school, I answered, looking my father straight in the eyes. Most students who start their education in Korean schools typically continue on to Korean-sponsored high schools and universities.
What's gotten into you all of a sudden?
My citizenship had changed from North Korean to South Korean almost overnight, but nothing about me had changed. Nothing about me was changing, and I was bored. With that change in citizenship, I felt like I had any number of choices before me. I want to see the wide world, I answered with the same determination. A conflicted look of joy and worry came over my father's face.
Do what you want.
And that's how I quit being a North Korean resident of Japan, busted out of the tiny confines of Korean school, and dove into the wide world. That decision, it turned out, came with some challenges. The great Bruce Springsteen. He sings about the struggles of the working class. I'm Zainichi. I've got my own struggles to sing about. Thought I was born in a righteous land, been beaten down about as low as you can. You end up trembling at every touch, like a dog that's been whooped too much. Born in Japan. I was born in Japan. That's right. I was born in Japan. 2. The door flew open. Some kid, a first year by the looks of him, stood outside the door, his bloodshot eyes searching the classroom. It was only a week into my third year at the Japanese school. His eyes found mine and locked on. I decided to ignore him and casually gazed at the anthropology book spread out on my desk. He stepped inside. The lunch bell had just rung, so there were plenty of students still hanging around the classroom. They dug out what loose change they had in their pockets and began placing bets. The kid walked past the lectern and made for my desk in the back row, slow and deliberate. I closed the book, slipped it into the drawer of my desk, and kept one hand inside the drawer. The kid stopped, slightly right of center in front of my desk. He loomed over the chair. I raised my eyes and looked up at his face. He was grunting noisily through his nose. The boy looked nervous, pale, like a child before the start of a race. His chapped lips were pulled tight.
Hurry up and hit me already.
If he attacked me now, I didn't stand a chance. In every altercation so far, not one of my challengers had made the first move. Not a single one. And because of this, I had a 23-0 record and was known throughout the school as the reigning badass. The kid opened his mouth as if to speak. I decided to cut him off. I was sick of hearing all the tired epithets.
"I'll make you famous," I said.
Billy the Kid said this when he drew his guns. The boy said nothing, letting out only a shallow, puzzled sigh. He might as well have had a question mark floating above his head. I grabbed the palm-sized ashtray hidden inside my desk, and in one swift move, pulled out my hand and sprang to my feet. His eyes clouded with dark terror the instant they seized on the ashtray. He managed to throw up his arms in defense, but I was faster. Like I said, you really ought to get in that first punch. I swung and smashed the ashtray against the bulge of his left brow, the supraorbital ridge, to be precise, with a little topspin. The skin there was thin and easy to cut. Right on the sweet spot. As the kid staggered back, his left hand went up to his brow. His eyes were out of focus. He was frozen in panic. I could have finished him there, but I waited. I wanted everyone in the gallery to get a good look. Within seconds, blood was streaming from between his fingers. People usually react to seeing blood in one of two ways: lose the will to fight or pump themselves into a frenzy. I had no idea which way this loser would react and had no intention of risking it. I decided to finish him off. I drilled him in the soft part of the knee, putting my full weight into the kick. The kid crashed into a couple of desks and went down on his side. After pushing my desk aside to make some room, I kicked him in the stomach again and again. Not with the tip, but with the top of the foot. A toe kick is harder to pull back on and was liable to rupture the internal organs, not to mention it doesn't make a sound. But with the top of the foot, it was easier to pull a kick, and a well-executed kick makes a thwack or a whump sound, making it the perfect deterrent to scare away any would-be challengers in the gallery. I stopped kicking. He was curled up like a newborn baby, trembling. A terrible feeling of sadness came over me. Damn it, if this poor kid wasn't somebody's precious child. After taking a breath, I slid my desk back to its usual spot. I put the ashtray back in the drawer, took out a tiny bottle of adrenaline solution from my bag, and tossed it in the kid's direction. Just a little of the stuff would stop the bleeding. Honestly, this act of pity wasn't going to do me any favors in the future. The students in the gallery were sure to spread rumors that Sugihara's gotten soft, which would bring all sorts of challengers like this kid out of the woodwork to take me down. But I think I'm in the clear. Today's trifecta of ashtray, blood, and kicking was a pretty good show, so by the time school got out, the story would have blown up into something like brick, head trauma, and bawling. If the story settled there, they'd be too spooked to challenge me until the start of summer break. Like Malcolm X said, "I don't call it violence when it's self-defense. I call it intelligence." I hated violence as much as Malcolm did, but sometimes you don't have a choice. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, do you turn the other cheek? Hell no! Some jerks will bypass the cheek and hit you where it hurts, even when you've done nothing to deserve it. I stepped past the kid, still trembling where he lay, and headed for the door. The dagger-like stares from the gallery were so sharp I could feel them against the back of my head. I spotted 3 100-yen coins on top of the desk by the door. Around the desk sat 3 students. I stopped and asked no one in particular, "Who'd you bet on?" They looked down at once. I slid the coins into my hand and left the classroom. As soon as I left, I realized that this was the first time I'd spoken to them. We've been in the same class for 2 years. I went to the cafeteria and bought some milk with one of the coins I'd just procured. Calcium is calming when you're feeling worked up. The cafeteria was pretty packed, but I managed to find an empty seat at a long table. The others at the table quit talking as soon as I sat down. This was nothing new. I punched the straw through the milk box and drank my milk. 3 minutes later, I was the only one sitting at the table. Once I drained the milk box, I made a game of knocking it over and writing it to pass the time. After I stood the milk box upright for about the 20th time, Kato came and sat down across from me, a stupid grin plastered across his face. I heard you took a wrench to someone's head. So the current rumor going around involved a wrench. I shook my head. It was an ashtray. You remember the ashtray. Kato narrowed his eyes and stroked the bridge of his too prominent nose with a loving finger. 3 years earlier, I'd been admitted to this private all-boys Japanese school, which had a rating about as high as the calories in an egg white. But as someone who'd been educated in Korean schools and studied less than a year for the entrance exams, getting in meant as much to me as if I'd been accepted to the University of Tokyo. One day, about 2 weeks before the start of the term, I was summoned to the high school. I was shown into the office where the vice principal and the teacher in charge of incoming first years asked me to attend school under an alias to avoid any problems. In other words, they wanted me to take a Japanese name and conceal my heritage because going by my Korean name might get me bullied. I take pride in my name passed down to me by my ancestors. Concealing it would be like throwing away my pride. I won't do it. Actually, those words never left my mouth. I did as I was told. Why? Because ever since I'd announced my intention to go to a Japanese high school, my Korean teachers had really laid into me. One teacher called me an ethnic traitor, a turncoat. I've been called worse, but more about that later. Branded an ethnic traitor, I decided to thoroughly betray the ethnicity to which I belong. But even though I'd agreed to go by a Japanese name, I had no intention of hiding that I was Korean. Not that I was going to brag about it either. At least I wasn't going to do it. But just as you might expect from a second-rate school, the teachers were second-rate too. And they listed the name of my junior high school, which includes the words North Korean, alongside my Japanese name, Sugihara, in the student register. The first challenger appeared before me 3 days after the entrance ceremony. Korean schools have always been seen as these exclusionary karate dojos crawling with thugs. A full contact dojo, no less. Needless to say, that was just a stereotype. Plenty of tender-hearted guys would rather spend a day in a meadow, weaving poppies into necklaces. Then there are the vicious types who would find no greater pleasure than in fighting brown bears over spawning salmon in a raging current. I'd be willing to bet that Japanese schools have their fair share of both, but sadly, the bears in the Korean schools have been fed a bellyful of discrimination. They keep feasting on that salmon, fattening up, growing more savage by the day. That frightening image is planted in the minds of the Japanese and takes root as the reality for all Koreans. So basically, to the students at my new school, I was a walking dojo signboard with the word Korean written across it. As in dojo yaburi, the practice of crashing a rival dojo and challenging its members to a match. If they beat me and returned with my signboard, they'd score points with their pals. Stupid, I know. But it made sense to me. The first challenger turned out to be Kato. Kato was a bona fide badass whose father was a top lieutenant in a criminal organization. I was pretty fired up, given how it was my first match, and I broke Kato's nose with an ashtray. Though I beat Kato easily enough, I worried about what his father's crew might do to me. Turned out to be a whole lot of worry over nothing. Kato saw his busted-up face as an opportunity to get plastic surgery on his nose, which he never much liked anyway. After a while, Kato showed up one day with a sheepish smile, rubbing the ridge of his shapely nose, and said, "Thanks a lot." His father, who also seemed pleased with the result, said, "You gave my kid an upgrade," and took me to dinner at an expensive restaurant in Ginza. Kato's father was missing the pinky finger on his left hand. Kato was the first friend I made in high school, and the only one I could ever call a true friend. Kato stopped rubbing his nose and said, as if he had just remembered, "Today's my birthday." "Well, you're not getting anything from me." "I wasn't expecting it." Kato produced a strip of paper from the pocket of his school uniform and handed it to me. "A ticket to my birthday party."
"A party? Who do you think you are?"
"Well, my old man's paying for it, so..."
"How much are you selling these things for?" I asked, referring to the ticket.
Kato smirked and said that it was a trade secret. Shoving the ticket in my pocket, I told him that I'd go if I was feeling up to it.
"There's going to be lots of cute girls there," Kato said. "I promise you a good time."
He got up from his seat, clicked his tongue, and added, "I almost forgot. My father wanted me to tell you to come by the house sometime."
"No thanks," I answered. "I don't like Yakuza. They bully the weak."
Kato made like he was about to cry.
"Come on, don't hate. He's trying to earn a living like everyone else. Besides, he really likes you. He's always going on about how you're going to be someone someday."
"All right," I answered. "I'll think about it." A look of relief came over his face. Kato said, "I'll see ya," and turned to leave.
"Tell your old man I said hi."
The Yakuza's son turned around, cracked a broad smile, and held up his hand as if to say, "You got it." After school. I didn't have any friends to hang out with, and after getting kicked off the basketball team the year before, I didn't have anywhere else to go but home. I didn't feel like going straight back, so I killed some time at the bookstore, reading anthropology and archaeology books. Eventually, I bought a book and went home. When I got home and went into the kitchen for some milk, I found my father sitting at the table with his arms crossed, sullen. There was no sign of my mother.
"Again?" I said, alluding to her absence as I cracked open the refrigerator. "She says she wants to go to Phuket with her friends," my old man said, pouting. "So let her, for crying out loud. You know we've been struggling lately," he spat out.
Until a few years ago, my father ran 4 prize exchange booths for several pachinko parlors, but now that number was down to 2. The reason goes something like this. One day, the police paid a visit to a pachinko parlor that my father did business with and informed the owner that my father had deep ties with the Yakuza, that his profits were fattening the wallets of the syndicate and bankrolling their activities. Then the police added, "If you insist on associating with those types, we're going to have to keep a close eye on you." The owner knew full well my father had no ties with the Yakuza, but knowing what would happen if he defied the state authorities, he had no choice but to obey. And just like that, the owner ended a 20-year relationship with my father, and a new exchange booth run by an ex-cop opened for business. Running a prize exchange booth was a pretty profitable business. True to their nickname, dogs, the police have a highly developed sense of smell and an amazing ability to sniff out money. When my father lost 2 exchange booths back to back, my mother cried foul and discrimination and bloody murder and all sorts of other things. To this, my father said,
"We've still got 2 booths. We had 0 in the beginning. We started with nothing. Now, I may not be good at math, but I know 2 is more than 0.
And he flashed a grin. In his 26 bouts as a professional boxer, my father was never knocked down. Not once did his knee touch the mat. That toughness earned him the nickname Reinforced Concrete. His ring name was Hideyoshi Sugihara, as in Toyotomi Hideyoshi, the 16th century ruler of Japan. The name was apparently decided by the gym's owner. It was not a popular name among his Zainichi friends.
One look at my father's grin and my mother's face had softened into a smile. Soon, tears trickled out of the corners of her slivered eyes. Such a shame. That same mother had apparently gotten into another argument with my father and left the house for the third time this year. Losing the exchange booths and going to Hawaii had made my mother stronger. The Korean character has always been deeply colored by Confucian ideals, and that tradition was passed on to the Zainichi community. Roughly put, Confucianism was about respecting your elders. In our household, that basically translated to, the wife and child are forbidden to oppose the head of the house. So at meals, my mother always served the old man two more dishes than herself or me. But after my parents came back from Hawaii, that number increased to four.
"What's with all the extra dishes lately?" my father asked one day after dinner, patting his bulging belly.
My mother, who was in the kitchen cleaning up, chirped, "I was hoping you'd get diabetes." While my father was reeling from this unexpected counterpunch, my mother came out of the kitchen and plopped down on a chair. Then she grabbed the weekly magazine from the edge of the table and began reading, the magazine propped up so my father and I could get a good look at the headline on the cover, "Monster Wife Laces Abusive Husband's Dinner with Arsenic." Peeking out from behind the magazine was a smile as wicked as Jack Nicholson's. And that's how Confucianism met its defeat. Henceforth, we all got an equal number of dishes, and my mother, who'd rarely been allowed to go out, started spending nights out at the movies, karaoke, and the salon with her friends. My mother was still in her 30s. After bringing the milk carton to my mouth and taking several gulps, I asked my father,
"If we're as bad off as you say, then how come you're golfing all the time? You even bought a membership. You're full of crap."
My father had taken up golf after he came back from Hawaii.
"Golf is the shot in the arm I need to keep me going," he offered lamely.
"You don't think housewives need a shot in the arm every now and then?"
"Let me tell you something about women. North Korea, South Korea, China, and every other country steeped in Confucianism are past their glory days," I cut in. "The days of acting all high and mighty just because you're a man or ridiculously old are over."
My father glowered.
"You got a few more years schooling than I did, and now you're going to lecture me?"
He'd only had an elementary school education because of the chaos during and after the war. I shoved the milk back in the refrigerator and scooted out of the kitchen. As I climbed the stairs, his voice caught me from behind.
"What about dinner?"
I yelled back down.
"Instant curry!"
As soon as I entered my room, I called my mother on the cordless. She always stayed with a girlfriend who owned a yakiniku restaurant. No one answered at the house, so I called the restaurant. My mom picked up the phone. She said something about being busy prepping for the dinner rush and asked, "How's he doing?"
"I'd give him about 2 weeks."
"2 weeks? Don't worry, I'll survive." "I'm sorry to put you out. Why don't you come to the restaurant for dinner? Everyone here wants to see you."
"Yeah,
soon, I promise." After I hung up the phone, I got out of my school uniform and stretched out on the bed in my boxers. I heard putt, putt, putt from down below. The old man must have started practicing his putting. Whenever he fell into a funk, he practiced his putting stroke for hours and hours, like some kind of self-imposed discipline training. Putt, putt. The steady noise began to sound like the gloomy patter of raindrops. I was feeling hungry, but was in no mood to eat curry that came out of a pouch. I jumped out of bed, reached into the pocket of the school jacket hanging from a hanger, and took out the ticket to Kato's birthday party. I checked the back of the ticket. The party was in Roppongi. Not a neighborhood I particularly liked. Thinking it was better than being stuck in the house, I decided to go out. I put on a black turtleneck sweater and some blue jeans. I stuck my head into the living room and told my father I'd be home late. He muttered cheerlessly,
"Stay out of trouble,"
without bothering to look up. Putt. 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 But I'd give him a week. I left the house. I got off the Yamanote line at Ebisu, transferred to the Hibiya line, and arrived in Roppongi. I turned off Roppongi Street at Almond Cafe and walked all the way down Gaien Higashi Street, just shy of Toranomon. The club where Kato's party was being held, Z, stood away from the main street. When I opened the heavy wooden door, a muddle of dance beats, cigarette smoke, the stench of alcohol and body heat came flooding out of the dim interior. As much as I tried to dodge any of the offensive sensations, it was no use. I took a deep breath, getting my fill of the fresh outside air, and went inside. Z was a loft-style club. The first floor where you entered was a loft, and the spacious area below was a dance floor. Takeshita, a kid from school who was always hanging with Kato, was stationed by the door, holding a wad of tickets in his hand. He must have been roped into ticket duty. He mugged a look of shock upon seeing me.
"Didn't think you'd show up," said Takeshita.
I gave him a lazy nod and handed him my ticket. A mob of bodies gyrated to a thumping beat on the floor below. I scanned the loft area. Most of the tables were occupied. Tracking my gaze, Takeshita asked,
"Want me to clear your table?"
Dubious, I asked,
"Can you?"
Takeshita shrugged. He walked up to a couple sitting at a round bar table and whispered something in their ears. The couple rose reluctantly to their feet and disappeared down the stairs to the dance floor. Takeshita returned and made an okay sign with his fingers. When I thanked him, a genuine look of surprise came over his face. I guess my reputation around school is that I'm some kind of jerk. I made my way to the table against the wall and sat down on one of the stools. The couple next to me was tangled in an intense tongue kiss. I got uncomfortable looking at them, so I leaned out over the railing and stared down at the floor below. People were dancing, giving off heat from every pore, at times looking over their shoulders so as not to bump into the dancers nearby. Their movements looked oddly the same. A kid with a different air about him was coming up the stairs, holding two glasses. It was Kato.
"Thanks for coming."
He set one of the glasses on the table and sat on a stool.
"Iced oolong tea, right?"
"Yeah, thanks." We clinked glasses.
"Congratulations on being born," I said, after taking a sip.
Kato let out a sheepish laugh and glanced downward.
"Oh, hey."
He stuck a hand in his pocket, took out a tiny matchbox and set it on the table.
"What's this?" I asked.
"LSD. You're welcome to it if you want," said Kato, smiling and lowering his eyes timidly.
I adored Kato. This awkward kid who had no clue how to make any display of friendship because he was never taught how, and yet he smiled that innocent, bashful smile. I gently wrapped the back of his hand with a fist.
"Thanks, but I don't have time to get high. I've got a lot of things going on in my head. Once I get them figured out, we'll get wasted."
Kato peered into my eyes and grinned as if he read something in them.
"Or maybe you'd prefer one of these," he said, holding up a pinky finger, the Japanese gesture for a girl.
I laughed and shook my head.
"Nah, but I could use a sandwich or some fruit or something."
Kato nodded and got up from the stool.
"Hey,"
I called out toward his back. When he turned around, I tossed the matchbox at him. Kato made a smooth catch and batted both eyes at me in a failed attempt at a wink. Just as Kato was descending the stairs, the heavy door opened. A lone girl walked through it. From where I sat, I could only see her from the waist up. Her hair was short, like Jean Seberg's in Breathless. I loved Jean Seberg in Breathless. Her eyes were round and lovely, even from a distance, brimming with the same kind of intelligence as Winona Ryder in The Age of Innocence. I loved Winona Ryder in The Age of Innocence. My eyes drifted down to her nose, to her mouth, until she gave her head a toss as if to spurn my advances. The girl handed Takeshita a ticket somewhat absentmindedly and scanned the dance floor. I studied every minute change in her expression. A guy with long black hair and an earring dangling from one ear walked up to her. throw a rock in Shibuya, and 9 times out of 10, you'd hit someone that was the spitting image of this guy. He was a clone. I sipped my iced oolong tea, a little disappointed to know that this was the one she was looking for. The clone leaned in and said something to her. The girl shot him a cold, piercing look that ripped out his heart, crumpled it up into a ball, and tossed it aside. Struck dumb, the clone shrugged in shame before slinking back to where he came from. Clearly, she had a special kind of magnetism that drew the gazes of the men around her. I was no exception. I put down my glass. Abandoning her search of the first floor, the girl looked to the loft. She resumed her search at one end of the C-shaped loft. I was sitting on the other end. Slowly, her intense gaze passed over the tables one by one, as if she were crossing each one off in her head before moving on to the next. There were quite a few tables in the loft area. She sighed softly, her eyes stopping about 2 tables away from mine. The light in her eyes seemed to dim a little. She continued to scan the rest of the tables, as if she simply wanted to finish what she started. Then she came to my table. Her eyes brightened again. She was staring at me, along with everyone else in the club who'd been tracking her gaze to see where it landed. Despite being taken aback, I fell into my usual habit and glared. I shot her the most vicious look I could. Oddly, a smile spread across her face. All the faces in the crowd melted into smiles at once. If I'd smiled too, and maybe even given her a big hug, I suppose the story would have ended happily ever after. But that didn't happen. I kept on glaring at her. I mean, I didn't have the slightest clue who she was. As the crowd sensed the unlikelihood of this scenario and began to turn its gaze back to our fair heroine, the heroine in question came toward me with a slight bounce in her step. I honestly thought she was a sister of one of the jerks I beat down and that she was going to pull out a knife and attack me, yelling, "This is for what you did to my brother!" But the knife never materialized, and instead, she came up to my table and hopped on the other stool. When she landed on the cushion, her short, tartan-pleated skirt blew up for a second, giving me a glimpse of her thighs and panties, both white. With that afterimage still with me, I looked back up into her unflinching eyes. I braced myself, expecting her to unleash that same devastating look she gave to the clone earlier. But I expected wrong. The girl smiled and looked right and left as if she were chasing a butterfly fluttering overhead. Then she peered into my eyes expectantly, as if to ask, "Well?" When I blinked and answered with a vacant stare, her eyes traced an arc right to left again, only more slowly this time. For an instant, I wondered if she might be a little wrong in the head. Maybe she really did see a butterfly, I thought, but quickly reconsidered. She appeared to be the most right-minded girl I'd ever met. She fixed a stare at me. But the sad truth was, I didn't recognize her face, no matter how good a look she gave me. When I continued to look at her quizzically, she dropped her shoulders a little in disappointment. But soon her eyes were lit with mischief again, as she grabbed hold of the edge of the table with both hands and began swiveling her stool back and forth. Just as I opened my mouth to ask her what she was doing, she twisted her body to the right as far as she could and, whee, uncoiled her hips and let go of the table at the same time. Despite capturing every little detail from the back of her head, nape, and back, I didn't recognize any part of her. She spun back around to face me, wearing a smile that seemed to say, "Pretty cool, huh?" She stuck out the tip of her tongue. Years ago, I used to have a puppy that slept with her tongue always sticking out of her mouth. The girl reminded me of the puppy just then. Finally, I asked, "Do I know you?" Her smile vanished and gave way to a look colored with resignation, but only for a moment. "Have you ever heard of psychometry?" she asked. Her voice was prim and firm. I thought about it and nodded.
Psychometry was a kind of psychic ability to see the future or past by touching someone or something belonging to that person. I only knew this because I liked The Dead Zone and had seen the movie several times. After seeing me nod, she put her hands over the backs of mine, resting on the table. Her fingers were slender, delicate, not bony in the knuckles, straight. Her forefingers slid gently over the backs of my hands. Then they stood on end and moved back and forth on my hands.
"I'm reading you right now," she said softly.
I kept quiet and watched her fingers moving. I can't tell you when humans first began to use their hands, but right then, I wanted to thank that first person. The girl let go of my hands. That mischievous look came into her eyes again.
"You play basketball?"
"How did you know?" I asked, making no secret of my surprise.
"I told you. It's psychometry."
I stared at her face in silence for a moment and asked, "What else did you learn?"
"You've kicked a couple of people."
I took my eyes off her and scanned my surroundings. Most of the crowd had lost interest in the sight of us. I locked eyes with Takeshita by the door. He put on a bugged-out look of surprise. I scanned the room for Kato. I knew he had to be behind the girl's appearance. As luck would have it, Kato was coming up the stairs with a plate of sandwiches. Upon reaching the top of the staircase, he caught a glimpse of the girl sitting across from me and knitted his brows. When he came around the table and stole a peek at the girl's face, the vertical creases in his forehead faded, and laugh lines appeared around his eyes. After smiling at the girl politely, Kato set the plate of sandwiches before us, bowed ceremoniously like a well-trained waiter, and moved off.
"Someone you know?" the girl asked.
I tried to read her eyes. She didn't seem like she was acting. Kato didn't look like he was trying to put one over on me either.
So what the hell was going on?
The only thing I could think of was that she knew someone at my high school and had pumped him for information about me, but her facts were just a bit off from the actual story. Although I used to play basketball, I wasn't exactly playing now, and I didn't kick just a couple of people, but a whole mess of people. Even if she did have something on me, what reason would she have for going out of her way to tell me about it? Besides, the only thing any of the guys at school would tell her would have been, "Stay away from him." "What else did you learn?" I asked again. As an indifferent smile came across her lips, she said,
"That's all for today. Do you want to get out of here? This place is so crowded and claustrophobic and loud and boring, don't you think?"
I couldn't help but ask, "Did you read that from me too?" A mysterious smile played on her lips.
"Let's go."
She hopped off the stool and headed for the door with the same bounce in her step as when she first entered. I don't know whether or not she was just convinced that I'd follow, but she never once looked back to see if I was behind her. She was right. Her magnetism pulled me right off the stool. But the sandwiches on the table were also giving off their own magnetic force, however faint, and were begging to be sucked into my belly. The girl's back was receding into the distance. I gave up on the sandwiches and left the table behind. As I opened the door to leave, the people on the dance floor below began to sing "Happy Birthday," a few tentative bars that quickly grew into a rousing chorus. I thought about sticking around to the end of the song out of respect for Kato, but one look at the girl standing on her tippy toes, waving both arms at me, and I abandoned all reservation. I shut the door behind me and ran after her. We decided to walk toward Tokyo Tower. Not down any particular route, but whichever way our mood took us. The tower, lit up against the night sky, made a good marker. The girl and I walked in silence, but there wasn't any awkwardness between us. Every so often she would peer into my eyes, which made me crack an embarrassed grin, and she'd playfully ram her shoulder against me, like a hockey player, with all her might. I once saw a video of this bear cub sniffing curiously at a video camera and then slamming right into it. The girl reminded me of that cub. I wanted to know more about her. After we walked for about half an hour, I decided to break the silence. So, are you in high school? The girl nodded and told me the name of a private school. It was a famous prep school. I just started year three. Are you second year or third? She spoke as if she knew me. I have as well, I answered. I just started year three. She frowned, wrinkling her intellectual forehead. I have as well? That doesn't sound like you. What did she know about me? When I told her the name of my high school, she arched a brow as if to say, Yes, I know. That sweater looks good on you, she said out of the blue. You look like the boy from The 400 Blows.